Welcome to Commons and Chronicles, the podcast where we talk about all the best Creative Commons and reusable open game license content. If you need resources for your creative writing, game design, or you just love lore, Commons and Chronicles is for you. This is Klaatu. This episode, we're going to talk about the rest of the Gods of Pegana pantheon, starting with Sish, the Destroyer of Hours. For Sish, I went a little bit evil, and Sish is a pretty complex one, partly because Sish is more than just Sish. So Sish is a god who owns time. So time is the hound of Sish. So time isn't a god, it's just the dog of a god, and Sish is said to move forward at a steady pace, and time precedes Sish. Kib moves before Sish, and Mung moves behind Sish. Sish never goes backwards, and Sish is, from what I can tell, pretty unforgiving, pretty unrelenting. For some time, the gods dwelt among humans in a place called Warnath Mavai, which is a garden. The gods left Warnath Mavai, and it still exists somewhere in the south, but no man has ever been able to reach it. One time, a prophet glimpsed Warnath Mavai, but Sish set the hound, time, upon the prophet. So Sish kind of guards Warnath Mavai, and Sish tells time what to do. For Sish, since he is called the Destroyer of Hours in the source text, and he is unrelenting, I kind of put him as neutral evil, just because I don't see any reason he should kick people out of the garden and sick his dog on them just because they glimpse the garden. I think that seemed pretty evil. And otherwise, he's pretty neutral. He doesn't seem to really care about good or evil or law or chaos. But he does seem to really like unrelenting decay. So, domains: chaos, destruction, madness, and repose. Rituals: sabotage, destruction, live sacrifice. So, like I said, I went a little bit evil because I was really straining to find someone properly evil to throw into the pantheon. And I think, like many of the others, you could argue that Sish is probably more neutral than anything, but that's kind of a running theme, and it's difficult to build a pantheon with no evil gods, because then none of your bad guys have any reason for doing what they do. Next up is Zodrak. Zodrak was a shepherd. I mentioned him in the previous episode. The gods brought him to Pegana because he was a simple shepherd, and they were bored. So they brought him up to Pegana, and they kind of figured he was a safe bet, you know, like he would be entertaining, but he wouldn't be too much trouble. So they talked to him for a while, and then when they got bored again, they were going to return him to Earth. But then he remembered this law that people kept talking about back down on Earth, and the law was that anyone who looks, or a myth, I guess, anyone who looks into the eyes of the gods has the right to become a god themselves. And so Zodrak invoked this law or myth, and the gods kind of admitted that yeah it's true, if you look in our eyes you can become a god. So they made him a god. The source text is not super firm on what level of god Zodrak got to be. I mean, he gets to do a bunch of stuff, but it doesn't really explain, like, is he now a god forever? Like, does he exist in Pegana? It doesn't really explain that. So I'm assuming he does. I'm assuming he ascended into godhood, and that he could act as a god. And we do know that he did a bunch of things. I mean, he decided of his own will to provide mankind with a bunch of stuff. So he wanted to give them wealth and love because he wanted to make people happy. And all the gods asked, you know, what is wealth and what is love, and he kind of explained it, and he thought he was a little bit misguided for wanting to do this, but he did it anyway, against the advice of the gods. And in fact, tragically, he only brought misery to humans, because once they learned what wealth was themselves, they knew what it was to be poor. When they learned what love was, they knew what it was they knew loss. So he had all these great intentions, but unfortunately it all kind of went wrong on him. So I feel like he's obviously a good god, so the alignment, I would say, was neutral good, because I don't get the sense that he has any sense for law, although he did invoke law to become a god. I felt like that was sort of just to become a god. As a god, he clearly goes against the advice of other gods, so I feel like he's kind of neutral, and that he wants to spread good, and that's really his interest. His domains, I feel, could be luck, charm, strength, and glory. And rituals, I think he would really appreciate any act of charity. And then there's Slid, S-L-I-D. Slid is the god of gliding waters and foaming waters and still waters. The ocean is the soul of Slid. So Slid's, I guess, you could style him as being pretty much a sea god. I mean, that's kind of what he would be, or he or she would be. I don't remember which gods were actually assigned genders. Not all of them were, and then even the ones who were, it doesn't really get mentioned a whole lot. But Slid is the god of water, so I didn't have a whole lot of information to go off of for Slid, so I made him neutral-neutral, which, again, a lot of these gods could just be summarily put into the neutral-neutral alignment, but I feel like he's neutral-neutral, because the ocean is neutral. I mean, it doesn't care if you're good or bad. If it's going to swallow you, it's going to swallow you. Domains, luck, charm, water, and travel. For clerics of Slid, I could imagine things having to do with water, you know, whether it's anointing with holy water, or maintaining a mirror pond, or just having a fountain, you know, like running water around, which obviously could be really good for going up against vampires. So, yeah, Slid could be an interesting god if you took him on. Next up is Limpang Tung. That's Limpang-Tung. Limpang Tung. Limpang Tung is the new god of mirth. The old one, of course, being Hujizai, who learnt all the secrets of Mana Yud Sushai and got depressed thereafter, so no longer abandoned the realm or the domain of mirth. But Limpang Tung took up the mantle and is the god of mirth and melodious minstrels. Limpang Tung is the god of dance, jest, and entertainment. Interestingly, Limpang Tung also paints the sky twice a day and vows to never paint it the same twice. Limpang Tung has expressly no understanding of the mechanisms of other gods. Limpang Tung cares only about providing celebration and festivity. Limpang Tung says that pretty explicitly in the source text. I think the alignment here is clear, chaotic good. Domains, sun, darkness. Again, kind of an interesting mix for domains, but Limpang Tung does paint both the dawn and the dusk, so it's fair. Sun, darkness, fire, weather, and air. Rituals, it's an obvious shoe-in for singing, dancing, any kind of celebration I think Limpang Tung would probably appreciate. You can definitely imagine a bard being a follower of Limpang Tung. The next god is Yoharneth Lahai. Yoharneth Lahai is the god of little dreams and fancies. Yoharneth Lahai travels from Pagana in a boat full of dreams down the river Imrana, which, if you'll recall, is the river of silence that descends from Pagana, the realm of the gods. Yoharneth Lahai brings dreams to all people at night, both kings and paupers, and in fact, Yoharneth Lahai is so intent on doing this that Yoharneth Lahai often forgets who is a king and who's a pauper. So dreams get mixed up and thrown around willy-nilly. The other gods make fun of Yoharneth Lahai for going to all this trouble, but Yoharneth Lahai does it anyway. I think it kind of spells it out for us. The alignment would be chaotic neutral, domains, charm, trickery, liberation, and magic. Rituals. I think ritualistically, like a lucid dream, you know, where you're dreaming, but you know you're dreaming, that sort of thing. I think that would be like a cleric's goal every night, you know, to have some kind of vision or whatever. And I think that would be connection with Yoharneth Lahai. Okay. Next up is Sirami, S-I-R-A-M-I. Sirami is not a whole lot is said about Sirami, but I guess when they don't say that they're expressly good or happy, I kind of just throw them into the evil lot, because we just don't get that many evil things. But Sirami I put into the alignment of lawful evil. Sirami is the god who returns people from dreams. So Sirami stops dreaming, and it makes people forget what they witnessed in dreams. Some things get through, it's expressly said, but it's kind of like this realm of secrecy that Sirami has domain over. So I figure lawful evil could be kind of good for Sirami. It just kind of feels like a nice fit. Domains, sun, since Sirami stops dreaming. Scaly kind, if you're a Pathfinder rule set, then scaly kind is the reptilian domain. Law and evil. Rituals, sleep deprivation, study, record keeping, things that keep you awake and you stay awake in spite of wanting to sleep. I think that would be an interesting kind of ritualistic sleep deprivation for clerics of Sirami. And I think people tend to go a little bit crazy when they, I know if I've stayed up for 2 days straight, I go a little bit crazy. I don't do human sacrifice, but I mean, you could make your bad guy do that. Okay, so after Sirami, I've got Roon, R-O-O-N. Now, Roon is a very confusing god name because there are things called runes already established in pretty much any fantasy universe, so I figure if Roon is too confusing, just add something to the end of the name, Runos, or something like that. Roon is the god of moving. Well, so no, the Roon is the god of going. There are gods of moving and gods of standing still, but Roon is the god of going. I guess it's kind of a mantra or whatever, a koan, because it's pretty confusing, but that's what Roon is, the god of going. And it's because of Roon that nothing in the world ever stands truly still. It's kind of profound, you know, because, I mean, we know about molecules and atoms, so the idea that nothing ever truly stands still because of Roon really fits in with modern interpretation, and you could take that and really run with it, you know, teleportation or something like that, who knows? Just all kinds of weird destruction. And because of that, I figured it's great to embrace chaos for Roon, I think. So alignment, let's go with chaotic neutral. Domains, travel, weather, chaos, war, and liberation. I think rituals for Roon could have something to do with motion, you know? I mean, you could go any way with it. You could say, okay, Tai Chi or some kind of martial kind of exercise or something could be cool. Or you could go with just the glory of battle, you know, a barbarian who's just completely chaotic, going out there raging, you know, keeping things moving, keeping things in chaos. I feel like that would fit as well. So you could sort of take it in many different directions to praise Roon. Next up is Ranurada. And now you're going to see kind of what I was talking about. I mean, between Zodrak and Ranurada and Skarl, the definitions of what exactly is a god and what isn't a god gets really, really hazy a lot of times within the gods of Pagana. So I'm taking Ranurada as a god, but it might be a stretch. Here's what the deal is with Ranurada. So in the center of the seventh desert, so there are seven deserts around Pagana, and in the center of the seventh desert is a living hill named Ranurada, the Eye of the Waste. Around the base of Ranurada are carved mystic letters vaster than the beds of streams, and it reads, "To the God who knows." Legend has it that Ranurada was fashioned in the image of Hudrazai, the former god of mirth, who, of course, discovered all the secrets and now stands around in Pagana and says nothing. For this reason, this site is a pilgrimage, and so people try to come to this hill called Ranarada and worship. The problem is that to get there, it's really kind of tough. So there's these seven deserts you have to get through. The first desert, there are tracks of mighty travelers outward from Badrahan, some returning. In the second desert, outward tracks, none return. Third, desert untrodden by human feet, which says to me that no one's gotten to the third desert, but I guess maybe they were riding camels, and so literally no human feet. Fourth, sand. Fifth, dust. Sixth, stones. Seventh, the desert of deserts. In the center of this dwells Ranarada. So it's all very mystical and kind of confusing and doesn't really explain a whole lot, but I figured Ranarada sounds like a holy thing. And there's another god kind of like Ranarada in haziness. It's called Tregul, which is the thing that is neither god nor beast. And since that spells it out, says it's not a god, I don't count that as a god. But Ranarada I'm taking as a god, and I'm saying that Ranarada is a lawful good god. With the domains of knowledge, runes, makes sense, strength, and void. Rituals, I think meditation would be perfect. So that's really all the gods of Pagana. The problem that, if you're following along very carefully, you might notice is that there's no chaotic evil god to be found among them. I couldn't, even at my worst, I just could not stretch some of these any of these gods to be a chaotic evil. Maybe, what's his name? Sish. Or what's that other one? No, Sish, I think, is probably the closest I can think of to a chaotic evil. But even that, I just felt chaotic evil. It's quite different. But, I mean, the one that came to mind immediately was just to rip off Lovecraft. And Lovecraft and Lord Dunsany were in correspondence, so I don't think it's that much of a stretch to kind of have them collide a little bit. And so if you're a Lovecraft fan, you already know where I'm going with this probably, but Nyarlathotep is begging to be the chaotic evil god of someone's pantheon, probably already is, but might as well serve that role here. Now, if you think that Nyarlathotep sounds a little bit too Egyptian or too Lovecraftian, I came across online some alternate names. I don't know where they came up with these names, but one on Wikipedia was Shugoran, Shugoran, which kind of sounds Pagana to me, like Shugoran, Ranarada, Yaharnathlahai. It sounds all basically similar enough. So whatever you call this entity, it would be the crawling chaos beyond the world's vague ghosts of monstrous things. In the graveyard of the universe is the detestable pounding and piping music to which demons dance around the gigantic tenebrous ultimate god, the blind, voiceless, mindless gargoyles whose soul is Nyarlathotep, the crawling chaos. That's a paraphrase from Lovecraft, so don't think I wrote that well. That's all Lovecraft. Alignment, chaotic evil. Domains, chaos, destruction, madness, death. Rituals, destruction, mayhem, chaos, self-destruction especially. So those are all the major gods of Pagana. Between the previous episode and this one, we've covered all, I think 11 of them. I keep forgetting to actually take a count. But those are the major gods. Remember that none of them actually accept prayers from their followers. So they're not a very talkative bunch. And there's not a whole lot of information about them. I mean, what I've told you in these two episodes is basically the takeaway from the book. If you read the book yourself, you'll find that I'm not leaving a whole lot out. It's really not a long book. It's not very detailed. It's very colorful, very sort of for lack of a better analogy, it's, you know, biblical sounding. It's very self-important and very official sounding. But it doesn't really give you a whole lot about their personalities. And I think especially after the long, rich history that we have with Forgotten Realms and other settings, and certainly the gods of Porphyra, maybe I certainly wanted a little bit more juice about what these gods were up to. You just don't get it. It's just not there. So you can either flesh that out for yourself, or you can take the stance that that's how gods are in this world, and your players can live with it. And that might be a fair way to play a campaign, where your clerics do get their powers, but they don't have any personal relationship with their god. They can't really get information from the god or feelings from the god. They get the source of their power from the god, and that's it. That's all the interaction that they receive. So it could be kind of a dystopic sound, a feeling, kind of empty world, in that way. Now, where Pagana does offer a lot of flexibility, where you could go probably a completely opposite direction, is the fact that all the major gods that we've talked about in this and the previous episode have said very explicitly, don't pray to us, pray to the home gods. So there are 1,000 or maybe more, but they said, I think, 1,000 home gods. These are the little gods that just do daily tasks. They sit on the hearth and mind the fire and things like that. So these gods aren't in Pagana. They live on Earth. And there are, like I say, at least 1,000 of them. So we don't know all of them, but therein lies a lot of flexibility. It does list quite a few of them, so I'm going to go through them really quickly. I didn't assign them domains or anything. I just, actually I did, sorry. I don't remember doing that, but I did. But here they are. So there's Habaniah, Lord of Glowing Embers, domain fire, obviously. Zumbibu, the Lord of Dust, domains air and earth. Gribbon, sits in the heart of the fire to turn wood to ash. I think domain fire and destruction is appropriate there. Kilulugung is the god of smoke. Kilulugung. The domain would be air, I guess. Pitsu. This is the god that pets your cat. I kid you not. The domain is animal, I think. Hobith is the dog that calms dogs. Again, I'm not making these up. These are all from the source book. The domain there would again be dog, would be animal, I think. Jabim is the god of broken things. Jabim laments broken things until they are mended, or until the world ends. Sometimes Jabim is also found by the river, mourning the forgotten things that drift by. Domain destruction and yet healing, I think, would be kind of a cool combination. Tribugi. The Lord of Dusk. Tribugi comes alive once all the fires in the hearth have gone out, and dances around the room and on the walls, but never disturbs the quiet. Domain, darkness. Hish, Lord of Silence. I guess that's why we say hush. Hish, Lord of Silence. Hish's children are bats. Hish makes all things quiet, except the crickets. The crickets rebelled against Hish one time, and so Hish put a curse on them to make them make the same noise thousands and thousands of times, so that it basically was the same as silence. You know, just the repetition just became, sank into the silence, became part of the silence. Hish ushers in Yaharneth Lahai, who, if you'll recall, is the god of dreams. Domain, darkness, animal, and earth. Wohun, the lord of noises in the nights, specifically noises in the nights. So foxes, wolves, and owls all serve Wohun and are active once Hish has gone out. So Hish keeps everything silent, but when Hish goes out into the world at dusk, or at night, once the fires have died, rather, Wohun then gets all of the animals, the nocturnal animals, to make noise. The domain, darkness, and probably chaos, to be fair. And then finally there's Umbul, the god of drought. Umbul helped Mung subdue 3 home gods of rivers, the Aimes, the Zanes, and the Segestrion. When they rebelled, they decided to play the games of the greater gods and started flooding in order to kill all the humans just for fun, because that's what gods do. And so Umbul came along, being the god of drought, and dried the rivers, or at least made them recede. The domain is weather and fire. And that's an interesting story that gets kind of... It's basically as quickly as I just related it to you, but the fact that these three rivers, these home gods of these three rivers, the Imes, the Zaans, and the Segastrium, decided to play like gods and go on a killing spree just because they could. That was actually quelled, if you caught it, by Mung and Umbul. And Mung being like the god of death, you wouldn't really expect Mung to say, hey, cut that out. Mung, I would have thought, would say, cool, let's do this. But no, Mung actually stepped in and said, no, you're just a home god. You don't have power over life and death like that. So it's kind of an interesting thing about the gods of Pagana is that they all do seem very, very, I don't know, maybe they're a little bit jealous. But Mung, that's one reason I gave him the alignment of lawful evil, because you know, it's one thing to say, well, there's death, and then quite another to say, oh, let's go on a killing spree. So the home gods, as you have heard, there are about, you know, 12, let's say, that are actually listed in the source text, which is great, but they're, well, 12, 15 plus the, you know, including the river gods maybe, but whatever. I'm just making up numbers, but it's something to keep in mind that if one pantheon does not suit, or if it's not detailed enough, as the Pagana pantheon arguably is not, then you could play a campaign where instead of having your 12 or your 9 rather gods of certain alignments, you could just have a 1,000 gods, and everything that a cleric does is related to some god, and so maybe they do serve one of the, you know, the main gods, but on a daily basis they actually interact with all of these home gods that they can actually pray to and beseech for blessings and things like that. I think that could be a really interesting world to play in, and that was my biggest takeaway from the gods of Pagana, I think, is that you could have a very different kind of experience if you just started telling your players, hey, you want to do something, create a god for it, because that's the entity that you're going to have to appease in order to get any kind of bonus from. And that could be really fun, and it really goes towards the collaborative storytelling side of role-playing, I think, when you've got your players just inventing gods for every little thing that they do. A god of beer, a god of coffee, a god of hotels, a god of, well, inns or taverns, a god of eating, a god of sleeping, a god of fire, a god of killing. Like I said, and I think in the previous episode, killing with a sword versus killing with a warhammer, killing with an axe, you know, just every little thing could have a god assigned to it, and you could just assign it whatever alignment and give it whatever domain seems appropriate and kind of see how that works out. And if not, hey, the gods of Pagana has a bunch of gods for you. I have assigned alignments and domains, which you're welcome to use or welcome to ignore. Either way, it's an interesting source material. It's fun. It's a good read. I would recommend it just for an afternoon if you're a quick reader. If not, get the audiobook and just have it on, because it is interesting. It sounds very important. It sounds like a big deal, and maybe it is, who knows, but it's got that sense to it, that profound, like, these are the gods sense to it. So it's an interesting read, definitely worth doing, and maybe it'll spark some ideas, or maybe it'll just lay a really solid groundwork for, hey, this is the history of reality. These are the stakes. This is why you can't talk to the gods. You've got to be quiet when you're around the gods. You can pray to the home gods, but not these other gods, because if we awaken Mana Yud Sushai, then everything ends. I mean, it's perfect. There's a lot to work with there. So, I don't know. Pretty interesting stuff. Gods of Pagana. Talk to you next time. That's it for this week's episode. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Klaatu. You can reach me via email at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can also usually catch me in IRC as not Klaatu. I'm on the Freenode network. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.